Broadcasting in English. You're listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. I'm Daniela Lazarová. Coming up in today's show, in Czech books, David Vaughan talks to writer Tomáš Meškal about his life and work. Then in science, we look at the rediscovery of a monkey believed to be extinct, and we'll wind up with another part of David Vaughan's popular history series from the archives. So do please stay with us. When Tomáš Meškal's first novel was published 4 years ago, one critic described it in ecstatic terms as a gold vein amid the deadwood of contemporary Czech scribbling. The book, A Love Letter in Cuneiform Script, went on to win the coveted European Union Prize for Literature last year, and Tomáš Meškal has won international acclaim, although we're still waiting for either of his two novels, published so far, to appear in English. David Vaughan talks to the writer in this week's books.
Now in his mid-40s, Tomáš Meškal has plenty of material to draw from in his own life and family. Although he says that as a writer he is cautious about exploring his own experience too deeply. Of mixed Czech and Congolese origin, he left his native Prague for London in 1987, returning again after the fall of communism. He studied English language and literature and has worked as a university and secondary school teacher. Both his published novels, A Love Letter in Cuneiform Script, which he has talked about in a previous edition of this programme, and the biography of a black and white lamb, are set in communist Czechoslovakia. But that is pretty much where their similarities end. I met Tomáš on a chilly winter morning in Prague to talk about his life and work, and he began by remembering his first impressions on leaving Czechoslovakia as a 21-year-old.
This is very exciting, but it was also more than 20 years ago, so I was young. But I still remember coming to Victoria Station, to the same station which in most English movies, when someone comes from the continent, so you come to the Victoria Station and I came to the same station, so it was quite fun. But the most interesting for me was the cultural life in London, because that, I mean, it still is, together with Paris, unsurpassed. So that I found very, very exciting.
And also the fact that your father was from Congo, you're half Czech, half Congolese, that suddenly you were in a context where people wouldn't look at you and find you in some way different or exotic.
It was, in a very strange way, very kind of calming influence, because London is a multicultural city and no one was surprised that I was mixed race or black, while at that time in Czechoslovakia, foreigners were very unusual, and I was considered by many people to be foreigner, so that was in a way very calming. So on the one hand, it was a very exciting time, but on the other hand, it was very kind of relaxing.
And people in London must have found it a bit of a surprise when they found out you were Czech.
I remember much later when I got friendly with one of my lecturers, so that he told me that when he saw my name and that I'm coming from Eastern Europe, so that he expected someone much older and with long white beard, someone like Tolstoy figure, which I didn't fit at all.
And it's quite interesting that we're talking here in your flat in Prague, and this is actually a flat that you've inherited through your mother's side of the family. On the wall there are some pictures of your Prague forebears. So on that side of the family, you seem to be from a very typical Prague middle-class family.
Yes, my family from my mother's side, they were accountants in two generations for different banks before the communists took it over. But actually they worked in the banks even after the communists took over, but they never made it, as it were. They were always frustrated because they didn't join the communist party, so like most people, they were not promoted.
On your father's side, your roots couldn't be more different in many ways, could they?
Well, yes and no. My father actually studied something like political economy, but he switched to politology and he finished with PhD in France in Sorbonne, and he finished his career as a professor of politology in Kinshasa.
And how did he come to be in Czechoslovakia from Congo?
Well, that is really rather strange fate, because in 1959 he was one of the people who helped with the demonstrations in Kinshasa, which were suppressed and several hundreds of people were killed, and he was also in fear of his life, so he escaped from Congo, and it took several months before he reached Ghana, and there he met with Patrice Lumumba and they planned independence of Congo. And he asked my father to go to some Eastern European country to get some support for independence of Congo. So my father actually got here as a, in a way, supporter of the Congo independence. That was really his main objective.
And with the twists and turns of fate, he ended up getting more or less stuck in Czechoslovakia, didn't he?
The Czechoslovak authorities thought that Congo didn't follow precisely the kind of leftish path, and he wasn't given, he promised official documents, and finally he got somehow in touch with Joseph Kasavubu, who was first president of Congo, and he was actually one of the organizers of this demonstration in 1959. And meanwhile, of course, he met my mother here in Prague, and Joseph Kasavubu sent him a diplomatic passport so he could leave Czechoslovakia.
In the meantime, in the mid-1960s, you were born.
Yes, he met my mother here. I was born, and he proposed my mother to go with him to Congo. But of course, the turbulent 60s meant that also meanwhile Patrice Lumumba was killed, and the Congo was on the brink of war. So my mother decided not to go, and this is how their relationship really ended. Although they were in touch for many years.
And so you grew up in Czechoslovakia. Obviously, when you were a very small child, the Soviet invasion came of 1968, and you were growing up in the period known as normalization of really very grey, hardline communism.
It was very difficult for my mother and for my grandparents, who were older, but when you grow up as a child, you really don't care, because you, first of all, you don't know anything about what happened, and everything what happened before you were born, it's like history, really. And secondly, you didn't have alternative. So we never really thought about it. The only thing where I really start to notice it was when I started to be interested in literature, because a lot of good Czech writers were not in the libraries, and you had to borrow them only in friends' houses. And so people like Milan Kundera or Josef Škvorecký or Bohumil Hrabal, they were not in the libraries. The best writers, they were simply prohibited. Which, of course, when you are a small child, it makes them very attractive. When it really began to be difficult was actually paradoxically after Gorbachev got to power in 1985, because the Czech top brass in the Communist Party decided that they are going to be even more hardline than they were before. And when I met my wife, then we decided that there was no really future.
And you recently visited Congo for the first time, and your father is still alive and you have relatives in Congo. Did it seem to you a completely foreign country?
The difference between Europe and Congo is such that there is almost nothing similar. There is, everything is different. And of course I was sheltered by my stepfamily, so the life isn't at all so grey as the news coming from Congo shows. But everything is so different, from the climate to the culture. But people, Congolese are very friendly culture, and people are very open. So there's a lot of positive things, but of course there is huge unemployment, for example, and there is also absolute capitalism, which we don't have in Europe, and I hope that we never will have, because you can get anything for money and nothing without money. I mean, so this is completely different. But of course I met my family there and my father, and that was very nice, yes.
There are so many families, of course, where parents are divided, they split up, but normally it's for personal reasons, as opposed to having all these other factors, the fact of your father's decision to go back to Congo, your mother's decision not to go, these very difficult decisions. It must have left wounds on both sides, I should imagine.
I think it was very hard for my mother. For me, I think it wasn't so difficult because children are, they get used to anything. I mean, that's really, and since I grew up without father, so I didn't miss him. I mean, but of course for my mother, it must have been very, very difficult, and she never talked about it. And when I asked her about it before she died, so she never simply talked about it. And for a writer, there is this kind of danger that you start to explore this history and start to write about it, which is a bit of temptation, which I don't think is actually very good. So I was always very kind of circumspect about it.
This brings us to the subject of your writing. Your two novels are called, one is called A Love Letter in Cuneiform Script. Your second novel is the biography of a black and white lamb. You say that you're not being directly autobiographical in these novels, but there are very clearly autobiographical elements in both novels, aren't there?
Well, I think in the first book there aren't really many autobiographical elements. In the second one there are, I think, three or four chapters which are inspired by my personal experience, but the main line is not autobiographical, but the main characters are mixed race. At the time, that was very unusual in Prague, so I thought it might be still interesting. And of course, the main line of the story is how it was to grow up in the 80s. So that was description of that period, and what I was mainly interested was to show this kind of conformism. Anybody who was unusual with his ideas or thoughts was always suspect.
And also anyone whose color of their skin was different as well. I mean, it's a theme of racism in the novel as well, isn't it?
Well, I tried to explore that a bit, but I think it wasn't really racism. I think it was much more this conformism that if anything was ordered by the authorities, they would follow it. And there was a complete lack of knowledge of any foreign culture. So even if you would come from Finland, you would be kind of unique.
And that conformism has also led to some of the extremes that we've seen in this country over the last 60 years, with the very hardline communism that came in the 1950s, and then the return again to hardline communism after 1968, which also figures quite prominently in your first novel, where you really look at the impact of these political developments on one family and how it wrecks the family effectively.
I think Czechoslovakia, as it used to be, prided itself on this kind of rationality and high living standard, because it was still one of the highest living standard in communist countries. But at the same time, there is this kind of like almost Jacobin kind of streak, you know. For example, when the communists took over, so they nationalized completely everything, even the small corner shops, you know. And so, for example, I saw for the first time the private corner shop when I was 15 or 16 and went to Poland, when there were private corner shops, because in Czechoslovakia there was everything nationalized and you have nothing private. So this was kind of uniqueness of the Czechoslovak, and actually I think not much more Czechoslovak, but Czech, because the situation in Slovakia was more tolerant than in the Czech part. But this is things which Czech society, I think, is still very uncomfortable for Czech society.
And I know that you're also writing about your experiences of visiting Congo.
I'm in the process of writing a series of reportages. I started by writing about the 60s and how my mother and my father met, and how it was in Prague and how it was in Brussels where my father lived afterwards. For me, what is interesting about it is not only about this personal story, but that how much they both were influenced by history, because he came to Europe for political reasons, he left for political reasons, then Czechoslovakia was invaded by Russians in 68, so the whole life again changed of the generation. So for me, it's kind of like learning experience.
And you're writing, you say, in a journalistic way about this. What about fiction?
I do what I promised myself never to do, that I writing on two books at the same time, which I never wanted to do. And one is a novel, and the other is the reportage book. But as far as the novel goes, so I still have at least another 1 or 2 years of writing. So I really don't want to get into the question of what is it all about, because I still don't know. I'm exploring it.
And do you think that Prague is the city where you would like to spend the rest of your life?
perhaps, you know, I'm a city person. I love cities, you know, I love countryside, but cities is kind of where I want to be because I love art and culture and I love meeting people. And Prague is definitely my home, that's for sure.
Tomáš Smeškal, thank you very much for talking to Radio Prague and best of luck for the future.
Thank you very much.
Writer Tomáš Smeškal was David Vaughan's guest in this week's edition of Czech Books. Now from the world of fiction to the world of science, here's a fresh edition of Science Journal with Christian Falvey.
Presbytis José Canicross, let's call him Miller's grizzled langur, is one of the rarest primates in the world, with hardly any pictures in existence and very few people having ever seen one. In fact, it was believed that the long-tailed monkey was extinct until scientists observing two natural springs in the Kutai National Park in Borneo came across one grizzled patron after another. It soon emerged that some of the scientists involved in the discovery were in fact from the Czech Academy of Sciences, and one of them, Alexandra Pospiech, told me more about the long-lost langur, beginning with what it looks like.
Well, it looks like a grey langur, or maybe a little bit similar to a white front-headed langur, but it's a subspecies which is quite rare, and it looks like a little grey monkey, but it has kind of white spots under its nose.
So it's not only the white spots under its nose that make it a subspecies, no?
I don't think it's the only sign, but the subspecies was described just from some skins in the museum. So there's definitely more of these signs, but it's kind of a cryptic animal and very little is known about them.
And what has threatened its existence exactly?
The biggest threat is the loss of habitats and the destruction of the rainforest, which is quite massive in Borneo, especially during last 50 years, about 50% of all the rainforest area in Borneo was destroyed, either by logging or in recent 20 or 30 years by replacement by oil palm plantations, coal mining, or planting acacias for paper industry.
So has the animal ever been seen, or is this the first ever finding, or when was it last seen?
It's not the first time, but as far as I know, there was just few occasions, and probably three of them are from similar spots from the Vehea forest. We observed the animals on mineral springs, where the monkeys come down from the trees and drink water which is rich in some special minerals they need. And one of the observations was on some bigger mineral springs, and I was the only one who observed them on some new mineral springs.
And in your observations, you actually found it quite often, as I understand it, or on more than half of the observation days.
Yes, I spent there 3 days in height, and on 2 days I saw the monkeys. And we have camera traps there for like 3 weeks before I went there to the height. And these monkeys were the most abundant animal on this mineral spring.
So it wasn't one. It wasn't one monkey. It was several. A family that you saw.
It was some troop. I think I saw at least four animals. I could distinguish. Maybe there were more, but I'm sure about four animals.
And how were you able to recognize that it was Miller's grizzled langur and not another type of langur?
We had a primatologist with us. His name is Dr. Stanislav Lhota, and actually he immediately recognized it. And after we came back from the expedition, we sent the photos to three primatologist taxonomists who confirmed the determination of this subspecies.
Other langurs at least live in large groups of up to 20 animals. So does that mean that for all the ones that you saw at the spring that there could be many more? Or is that being overly optimistic?
From the camera trap data, we saw more animals were visiting the smaller mineral spring. I saw only four, but there, on the camera traps, it seems that the troop is bigger. And I'm not sure how many animals it was on the bigger spring. It's also possible that it was several troops of different size. And we saw just, for example, two of them. So we have absolutely no idea about the total amount of these monkeys in the forest, and future research must be carried on.
Well, that's what I'd like to know. What can future research consist of?
Well, mostly it will be probably trying to determine the population density, some behavior data, because as far as I know, there are almost no behavior data on these animals. Also, it's quite interesting what's so special about the spring. What kind of minerals are there, and why these monkeys visit them so often?
And aside from the satisfaction of knowing that this animal still exists, what could we potentially learn from it?
We can learn that there is still about half of the forest left in Borneo, and it's a huge area, and it is mostly undiscovered. And there is a still chance, as long as the forest is untouched and conserved and it has some spots of primary forest, there can still new habitats and new species can be found, or even species we previously thought were extinct. But it is important to take steps towards the conservation of these rainforests.
So what are your personal plans for the future? Will you be going there again, and will you be involved in future research?
I'm not sure now, and it will be shown probably during following months, maybe years. I already spent with the Borneo projects about 5 or 6 years, so I have some photos and something which I would like to show first, and then we will see about future plans.
And what about other Czech biologists? Is Czech biology hard at work in Borneo?
Dr. Stanislav Hota is still in, right now he is in Sumatra, but he will be back in Borneo soon, and he goes there for a whole year. It's like his first time now. He spends 1 year in Czech Republic, 1 year in Borneo, and he runs a research and conservation project in Balikpapan Bay.
That was biologist and photographer Alexander Pospiech on the rediscovery of Miller's grizzled langur. That's all we have time for on today's Science Journal. I hope you'll tune in again next month for more from the world of Czech science.
Christian Falvey will be back with a fresh edition of Science in just 4 weeks' time. A reminder that you're tuned to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. And in the time we have left, let's take another walk down memory lane with David Vaughan.
The political reforms of the 1960s accelerated dramatically when on January the 5th, 1968, Alexander Dubček became first secretary of the Communist Party, the most powerful position in the country. Dubček immediately set Czechoslovakia on a course of economic and political reform to create what was described as socialism with a human face. Today we're going to hear two recordings of Dubček from 1968 that show both the hopes with which the year started and the despair which followed the Soviet invasion in August. First we go to a meeting of the Party Central Committee on April the 1st, which Dubček opened with a speech outlining the reforms. This extract reflects some of the paradoxes of the time, Dubček's sincere belief in change and his real enthusiasm at public support for reforms is evident. But at the same time, the speech is veiled in familiar jargon about the leading role of the party.
Zvláštnost celého tohoto procesu tkvě v tom, že byl v největší části hlavně jeho...
What has made this whole process so special, he said, is that above all, especially in terms of the pace of change, it has been determined by the creative and spontaneous activity of the broad mass of the people, with the communists in the vanguard. In this spirit, and in accord with the plenary session of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of Czechoslovakia, people have acted without the slightest manipulation and without being given commands from above. The role of the party is to recognize people's understanding, to raise it to a higher plane, to support progressive thinking and acts.
Dotvárať ho, zušľachťovať, vyzdvihovať progresívne myslenie a činy.
Dubček remained convinced that the political system could be reformed from within, even as the Soviet Union put growing pressure on Prague to reverse the process of change. He was completely shattered when his friend and comrade Leonid Brezhnev broke his word and sent tanks into Czechoslovakia on the night of August the 20th. The entire Czechoslovak Politburo was immediately swept off to Moscow and bullied into coming to terms with the invasion. They returned a few days later, but when Dubček went on air on August the 27th, he was a broken man.
Celkom otvorene chcem tiež povedať, že skúsenosť...
He tried to describe and explain the situation, talking in phrases that had little meaning, and after several sentences, his voice broke down completely.
Vážení poslucháči, prosím, aby ste mi preminuli, ak tu a tam sa prejaví nejaká prestávka.
He apologized to listeners and then went silent. The Czechoslovak radio journalist Margita Kolarová later remembered the moment that in many ways symbolized the tragedy of 1968 in an interview for Radio Prague.
Najednou zmlknul a nemluvil, byla pauze.
There was a silence. I didn't know what to do, whether I should start saying something to apologize to the listeners, but that wouldn't have been the diplomatic thing to do. So I waited, and I indicated to the people around that I needed a glass of water for Mr. Dubček. They brought the water, and as I put the glass on the table in front of him, the sound it made brought him back to his senses. After quite a long while, he began to speak again, and there were tears running down his face. It was only the second time in my life that I'd seen a man cry.
Viděla jsem po druhé v životě plakat muže.
David Vaughan there with From the Archives, a mini-series that Czech Radio is currently repeating, and I'm afraid that's all we have for you today. You'll find us online at radio.cz, and should you like to contact us, then the email address to write to is english@radio.cz. This is Daniela Lazarová saying thanks for listening, and do join us again soon.
écoutez Radio Prague.